gets a big mazel tov because she very recently got married. So, mazel tov and welcome. We're very excited.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to be back in a community that one has spoken at before because I kind of feel a sense of camaraderie already, even though I don't know most of you, but I'm hoping at the end of this year, we'll become, if not the best of friends, something close to that. I just want to clear up any confusion. The sheer title is "Let's Get Ready to Rumble: A Study in Talmudic Aggression." I recently read a bunch of articles about the language in Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi and the differences between how they approach the same topic, and I thought it was a really interesting shiur. For some reason, the title, when the shiur was being marketed, had a lot more words than this, but good news, I'm not Dickens. Nobody pays me by the word, but it'll be a good time anyways. So the shiur is split up into two sections. The first section I titled "I'm Rubber and You're Glue," and it goes into the different kinds of insults that appear in the Bavli versus the Yerushalmi. So readers of the Bavli stories are often really struck by how hostile and threatening the manners with which the different sages address one another. And the first source that I brought, we'll just dive right in, kind of is a primer to how people addressed one another. So the first source, it says, the sages taught, members of three groups hate other members of the same group: dogs, roosters, and the Persian priests. And some also say Torah scholars of Babylonia. So some rabbinic exchanges seem really suited to spiteful enemies as opposed to colleagues within the same school. And it's really interesting because they, for all intents and purposes, would have a common religion to guide them and a common teacher, but there's a lot of aggression and there's a lot of heads butting. And the first story that I brought appears in Bava Kamma, and it really illustrates the viciousness of interactions. To bring up a backstory, the halacha is brought down that if someone's walking on a road that is surrounded by private property, if there's some sort of obstacle in the road, or if there's some sort of danger in the road, one is able to go onto private property to circumvent that obstacle on the road. However, they say that some people were extra pious and did not do that. Can I have a volunteer to read source number two? If you make eye contact with me, I'll smile at you, and then I'll ask you to read. Can I ask you to read? Also, can I have your name by any chance? Yes. Hi, Hani. Oh, you can definitely read it in English, because I always say that people can choose to read it in Hebrew, but then I ask them to also read it in English, so it's either a two-for-one or a one-for-one.
Okay,
yeah.
So I'll just go right
in. Go for it.
I like it better. It's actually, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and Rabbi Chia were once walking along the road, and they veered off to the sides of the road. Rabbi Yehuda ben Kenosa was taking broad steps in the road to avoid the protrusions without going off to the side of the road while walking in front of them. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said to Rabbi Chia, "Who is this man who is showing off his supposed greatness in our presence?" Rabbi Chia said to Rabbi Yehuda, "Perhaps it is my student, Rabbi Yehuda ben Kenosa, and if so, all of his actions are undertaken for the sake of heaven." When they reached him, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi saw him, he said to him, "If you were not Rabbi Yehuda ben Kenosa, I would cut off your leg with iron shears."
So that's kind of taking it to an extreme. So just to recap the story, Rabbi Chia becomes really annoyed when he sees this sage observing a legal stringency, and by the fact that he's acting more stringent than he has to, he kind of views it as a display of insolence. And he responds that if it were not this very pious man, I would have cut that person's legs off with some iron shears. And he takes it really to the nth degree. However, in the Yerushalmi, we have nearly an identical story that it's a similar plot with different characters. And in this version, when Rabbi Yeshua tells Rabban Gamliel that Rabbi Yehuda ben Pappas's deeds are all for the sake of heaven, different characters, but the same idea, Rabbi Gamliel simply responds by questioning the stringency of the act. I'll read source number three because it's a little bit more roundabout. It stated, one may step on one side because of obstacles on the road, and when one sinks, even in a field full of saffrons. Rabbi Abahu said, it happened that Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua were on a road and stepped on the side because of obstacles on the road when they saw Rabbi Yehuda ben Papos, who was sinking, coming towards him. Rabbi Gamliel said to Rabbi Yoshua, who is this one who makes an exhibition of himself? He answered, it is Rabbi Yehuda ben Papos, all whose deeds are done for the sake of heaven. He said to him, did we not formulate that in anything that gives praise, not everyone who wants to distinguish himself may do so, i.e., don't go out of your way to act more pious than you have to. A scholar does, except if he has been appointed to a position of public authority. But if he's a scholar, he would be able to do this unless he is a figure who people should be emulating. He answered him, did we not also formulate in anything that gives pain, everyone who wants to distinguish himself may do so? A scholar does, and blessing may come to him. Rabbi Gamliel says, no, you're incorrect in your formulation of the halacha. He can do it if he wants to do it, but only if he doesn't shame others. So in a nearly exact situation, instead of saying, if you weren't Rabbi Yeshua ben Kenoza, I would have cut off your legs, he says, that's an interesting formulation of that idea. I disagree with you on these points. So we see that there is an intense sort of violence in Bavli as opposed to the Yerushalmi. And even if we take Rabbi Chiya's outburst, number one, in sort of a metaphoric sense, there's still kind of a bad taste in our mouth when we listen to language like that. In source number two, we have another story kind of illustrating the viciousness of the Bavli stories. In source number four, which happens in Bava Batra. So, background. The sages taught that the court appoints market inspectors to supervise the accuracy of the measures of the weights, but does not appoint market inspectors for supervising the prices of what's in the market. Would I be able to have a lovely volunteer to read source number four? Men are also lovely. Everyone.
I'm not intimidated by reading.
Please. May I just have your name by any chance?
Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much.
You don't need the backstory.
No, I read the backstory. We're good.
The Gemara relates the House of the Nasi appointed market inspectors for supervising both measures and prices. Shmuel said to his student, the sage Karna, go out and teach them that one appoints market inspectors for supervising measures, but one does not appoint market inspectors for prices. Karna went out and taught them that one appoints market inspectors for supervising both measure and prices. Shmuel, hearing what he had done, said to him, what is your name? He replied, Karna. Shmuel said, let a horn emerge in his eyes. A horn emerged in his eyes.
Yeah. In this story, it appears that Karna goes against what Shmuel asked him to do. Shmuel asked him just to oversee measures, not necessarily prices, but Karna, seemingly afraid of the Nasi's power, the Nasi who is the ruler of the Jews in the Roman diaspora, goes and oversees both measures and prices. And we see that in the story, Shmuel is so upset when Karna disobeys what he's asked to do that he kind of makes a pun and says, what's your name? Your name is Karna, horn. So, you know, a horn should come out of his head. And the story relates, I assume metaphorically, that a horn came out of his head. Or maybe in some sort of way he was marked as somebody who disobeyed Shmuel. I really like the onomatopoeia aspect of it. It's a pun, so I really like the pun aspect. And in source number five, we see again that the Yerushalmi has a much less violent version of the story. So the Yerushalmi version contains a similar story involving Rav and Karna, but Rav makes no violent comments despite the fact that Karna doesn't take out, doesn't follow his instructions exactly as he is asked. I'll read source number five. Rav was appointed market overseer by the head of diaspora. He intervened about measuring measures, but not prices. The head of the diaspora jailed him. Rav Karna went to see him and said, the market overseer about whom they spoke was for measures, but not prices. He answered, but you had stated the market overseer is for both measures and prices. So instead of being upset what's happening here, they're having a nice civil conversation about whether or not he understood his instructions. He said to him, go out and tell them the market overseer is for measures, but not prices. He went out and said to him, a person who teaches hidden things they send to jail. So he just relays that the person who told him this is in jail right now, but this is the law that we have to follow. We really see how quickly the Babylonian sages are to imprecate one another in their interpersonal actions. They immediately assume the worst of one another, as opposed to the Yerushalmi, who kind of take the benefit of the doubt and try to work through the interactions that they have. And we see later on kind of a quasi-rabbinic dispensation to heckle one another. In source number 6, we have a source in Tanit talking about comparing scholars and trees. Could I have a volunteer to read number 6 by any chance?
Rather, it is because it is written earlier in the same verse, you may eat of them, but you may not cut them down. And it is written in the next verse, them you may destroy and cut down. This indicates that there are certain trees which may be cut down, while others may not be destroyed. And so, if a Torah scholar is worthy, you may eat of them, but you may not cut them down. But if he's not worthy, he you may destroy and cut down.
So we see that the source is saying that if a scholar is worthy, you should eat from him, you should learn from him, and you shouldn't cut down this tree that gives you so much benefit. But if he's not worthy, if he's telling you things that you, for some reason, don't like or isn't up to par, you're definitely able to cut him down. You could destroy what he says. You can destroy that kind of standing that he would have. It really implies that poor performance is punished very severely. I wanted to ask how you all kind of felt about this.
Isn't that go against the
paradigm?
You're supposed to embarrass somebody.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to talk. I mean, it's not Lashon Hara, but it's just like degrading somebody.
Or v'yahavta l'reicha kamocha. That seems to be thrown out the window here. You know, it's really interesting. That's a really good point. We're actually going to discuss it in the last section of this year. So I appreciate that you brought it up.
It's something I noted before. I didn't realize your shaman is more civil. Grateful they have Twitter accounts.
Yeah. Very, very grateful, yeah. There's no tweet storm of insult between, you know, Rava and Abaye.
Wouldn't it also have a chilling effect on
dissent?
Well, but somebody who, why would you want to be a teacher? Why would you want to be a Rav? I mean, if you're going to get this kind of reaction,
yeah.
Some type of chilling
maybe
effect.
That was the point, right? To keep dissent out of.
Maybe that was just
here.
The culture of learning. Like, that's how you learned. It was sort of like
in
banter.
Yeah, no, that
like
you hit it right
banter,
on the...
Made it fun, you know, they're passionate.
They're on, that keeps you on your toes. Otherwise, you know, you'll be subject to a lot of heckling. You know...
Or whatever your name
is. So... We're all really right in picking up that this was predominantly a Bavli issue and not a Yerushalmi issue. And the differences between these two rabbinic schools, these two places, was acknowledged by the sages themselves. In source number 7, we see a direct delineation of this opinion. So in source number 7. I'll read it. It says, this demonstrates what Rev Oshia says. What is the meaning of that which is written? And I took for myself 2 staves. One I called graciousness, and the other I called binders, hovalim. Graciousness, these are the Torah scholars of Eretz Yisrael, who are gracious to one another in the discussions of halacha. They treat one another with honor and love, as demonstrated in the statements of Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Binders, hovalim, these are the Torah scholars of Babylon, who injure one another in discussions of halacha. Rabbi Yitzchak says, there are the Torah scholars of Eretz Yisrael who are pleasant to each other in discussions of halacha, like olive oil, which is not bitter, and the verse and 2 olive trees by it should be interpreted as follows. These are the Torah scholars of Babylonia who are bitter to one another in discussions of halacha, like an olive. So it goes into a lot of different metaphors about how the Babylonian scholars are much more angry and much bitter to one another than the Yerushalmi.
Blaming the place?
So he's. I don't think that he's putting blame in this source. I think that he's just kind of stating facts as he sees them in this kind of way. He uses a nice metaphor to bring out his point, to note the differences.
Is there a reason for
the difference? Yeah, there is. Stay tuned. Later on this year.
Is it the fact that they're in Eretz Yisrael,
the land? You know, that's really beautiful. I haven't found a source. That's so nice.
Thousands of years later.
times in other manner.
It was all overrun by all those other people who came in.
So, but you're right in saying that this animosity that is between the Babylonian scholars really apparently derives from the intensity with which these rabbis argued one another in points of law and halakha, each of them arguing passionately for their own point of view.
The stakes were very high in Babel, they weren't as high
in Yeah, so, again, stay tuned. Everybody's in step with me, and I really appreciate that. So there are sources we're going to see that the school of in Babylonia was much bigger than the ones in Eretz Yisrael, and because of that, there was a lot more jockeying for positions of greatness and power within that. So they needed to be on their toes for the entire time to kind of indicate that they were the most worthy, as opposed to the schools in Israel, which were not as large as the ones in Babylonia.
So I wasn't even talking about posturing. Like academic posturing. I was thinking more that, like in Babel, because it was Galut, it was so important to get halachot right.
Oh,
so
it's
not to lose the Jews. While in Israel, like, it didn't matter that much. If you walked around the property or through it, it was all going to be.
See, nobody actually brings that up, but I think it's. I would say that people in Babel thought that they were in the place where it was happening. They were in the place where things were happening, and the sages in Israel were like in the boondocks. And yeah, so, but that's really cool. Thank you. To bring it back to where I was, because that was a fascinating tangent. No, it's fine. I was saying that the animosity that was between these scholars was based on their debating different points of law, each passionately arguing for their own kind of defense. And despite the representation of actual violence in the stories, the damage is mostly verbal. They're not actually taking their fists and punching one another, though that seems well within their range that they could have had the ability to do that. The Babylonians really insult and embarrass and disparage their fellow sages while they contest different points of law. And in source number 8, I found this to be just a very moving story, but in a way that makes me very sad. I found the story fascinating, and it's a story of Reish Lakish and Rav Yochanan, a teacher-student relationship. And it could really help us understand how the halachic debate degenerates into real verbal damage that could have an effect on the participants. So the backstory to this Gemara is Rav Yochanan encountered a thief, a highwayman named Reish Lakish, and he kind of recruited him to his yeshiva, to his learning, and he taught this brigand Torah, and he made him a sage. In fact, he even married Reish Lakish to his own sister. And then the story continues that one day they had a disagreement in the academy. Rav Yochanan taught Reish Lakish Bible and then taught him Mishnah and turned him into a great man. Eventually, Reish Lakish became one of the outstanding Torah scholars of his generation. One day, the sages of the study hall were engaging in a dispute concerning the following braita. With regard to the sword, the knife, the dagger, the spear, the handsickle, the harvest sickle, when are they susceptible to ritual impurity? So when would these objects, when you're making them, would they be liable to turn into, to be able to accept tuma? Because a tool is something that can have tuma on it, not just raw materials. So they were asking, when is it in the state of their construction that this state of impurity could happen upon this utensil? The Braita answers, it is from the time of the completion of their manufacture, which is the halacha with regard to metal vessels in general. Okay. The sages then inquired, and when is the completion of their manufacture? So at what point are they finished tools? Rabbi Yochanan says, it is from when one fires these items in a furnace. Once you put it in the furnace, that's when they're finished. Reish Lakish says, no, there's one step further than that. It is from when one scours them in the water after they have been fired in the furnace. When you pour hot, cold water on them to solidify them, that's when they're finished. Rav Yochanan gets really ticked off at Reish Lakish that he says that, and he says to Reish Lakish, a bandit knows about his banditry. He says to him, yeah, like, you were a robber who used these kind of things, you would obviously know. He insults him for saying knowledge that he knows. Reish Lakish said to Rabbi Yochanan, what benefit did you provide me by bringing me close to Torah? There among the bandits, they called me leader of the bandits, and here too they call me leader of the bandits. Reish Lakish really upset, says, "What was the whole point of you educating me if you're just going to remind me of my past misdeeds?" Rav Yochanan said, "I provided benefit to you as I brought you close to God under the wings of the Divine Presence." But as a result of the quarrel, Rav Yochanan was offended, which in turn affected Reish Lakish, who fell ill. We see in the story that these words and this fight that they got into has real effect on the body, on the mental state of these people. Reish Lakish gets really dejected by the fact that Rav Yochanan insulted him in this way, so much so that he becomes very ill and later on dies because of this great insult. Rav Yochanan becomes despondent when Reish Lakish dies and goes on wandering, trying to find another student equal to the one that he formerly had. And this story is kind of a prelude to a lot of tragedy that happens later on in the story. And we see how a rejection of one's opinion really easily can be interpreted as a personal rejection, as opposed to interpreting the story as, "I disagree with you" when a tool is completed. It became really personal about their own character traits, and an attack on the position could be confused with an attack on one's person instead. And we see that the relationships between the Babylonian stages were a very tricky business, and they really depended on study partners for rigorous argumentation, but at the same time, they simultaneously risked insulting their partners in the heat of a debate. And there's this razor edge that really separates intense argumentation, which is a prerequisite for rabbinic life, from verbal insult, which could cause embarrassment and later on death. So I when I was reading this story, I was also thinking about how in the Gemara, when there is a rejection of an opinion, it sometimes says matkifle, which means he attacked him, to introduce a challenge to a sage's pronouncement of the halakha. And I just kept on going over that in my head. In GPAS, we study Gemara for a lot of hours a day, from about 9 to 1. And that kind of phrase that pops up all the time, I never really stopped to kind of think about and let it sit with me. What does it mean to attack somebody for their point of view? I wanted to throw the question back to you, lovely audience, and ask, I don't know, how does this resonate with you? I'm okay with silence. Yes?
Well, two things. One, I'm not sure whether Ramban was mimicking this behavior or just was popular then as well. In his commentary on Gemara, on Chumash, he routinely laces into Rashi and the Ben Ezra. So so more to your point. So these are the same people who could dissect a millimeter of legal transaction, but they can't tell the difference between insult and just disagreement. I find that curious.
It is very curious. It's not just in Chumash that the Ramban is very sharp with. My favorite interaction between the Ramban is in his attack of the Baal HaMeor when he defends the Rif. So the Ramban really was a student of Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, who was a 14th century rabbi in Spain, and the Baal HaMeor wrote an attack on the Rif's point of view. So the Ramban, anytime he used to discuss what the Baal HaMeor used to say, he wrote the Mishio de Lefaresh, like, wouldn't have explained it this way. I was like, the Ramban is cold. he pulls no punches. But you're really correct in saying that there appears to be a lot of erudition in parsing laws, but not necessarily within interpersonal skills. Yes?
The Gemara in Brachos, where you have that famous story with Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Gamliel, where, you know, there's also a personal interaction. So when they call in, they say, "We're going to wait for all the rabbis and we'll decide what to do." So then they give them a turn, Bali Trisa, the bearers of the shield. And so I've heard that explained, that if they're really interested in attacking, they would say they're bearer of the spears. But really what the whole purpose is not so much to attack, but to defend your own opinion. And so I think a lot of the interaction is not so much as an attack, but defending your own opinion. It may not be so personal, but I think that in the heat of the discussion, the emotion comes out, and you have to feel passionate about your opinion. So I think this is a lot of what we're reflecting, and that's why, you know, in your base camp, there's a lot of yelling and screaming going on, but it's not personal.
Right.
So if you're dealing with personalities, and maybe Reish Lakish always maybe had somewhat of an inferiority complex. And so this, you know, he always, like Aaron, you know, was always worried about the Chei HaEgel. And so, you know, maybe he unintentionally touched a person. And so the lesson for us is, you know, to try and be cognizant of other people's weaknesses.
Yeah.
But it may not be as vicious as it might appear to be.
It might appear to be on the surface level. That's wonderful. It's really interesting you bring up shield metaphors and spear metaphors, because we'll be in the next unit, which we're coming up to, we'll be talking about actual prohibitions against bringing weapons into the Beit Midrash for reasons that will become clear soon. So in section two of this year, I call it Orality and Violence, Holy War. So my first question after looking at all these sources was, why? So why are the sages in the Bavli, why are these Amoraim so argumentative, as opposed to the Yerushalmi? And in source number 9, Jeffrey Rubenstein, who is a professor at NYU currently in the Jewish Studies Department, he writes that the sages really conceived of their struggle to learn Torah and to perform the commandments as a holy war in and of itself. If I could get a volunteer to read number 9, it's only in English this time, so if I can get a volunteer, I would love for someone in the audience to read. Go for it. Thanks, Lonnie.
The sages conceived of their struggle to learn Torah as one commandment and not their fellow Jews who signed by on the Holy War. They were the ones who were battling against the tabernacles of Canaan to carry out that command. So they struggled, and they're working with professors, heretics, non-rabbinic Jews, the evil impulse, sin, laziness, and such like. However much the sages perceived themselves as a scholastic class of philosophers, they simultaneously saw themselves as soldiers waging war. This self-conception helps explain the violent tenor of rabbinic interactions.
So I found that fascinating, that they really viewed themselves as warriors of Torah, of this milchemta shel Torah. That kind of word is bandied about a lot in the Beit Midrash. Also, the Ramban wrote a defense of the Rif. It's called Milchamot Hashem, like the war of God. That when you're defending the point of view that you think is correct, that's the war. That's your own personal crusade, for lack of a better term. And in source number 10, we see that this prohibition of not bringing weapons into the study hall because of this this avira, this environment of passionate defense and passionate attacks based on your own point of view. So in source number 10, it is written with regard to Pinchas, he rose amidst the assembly and he took a spear in his hand. From here, where it is written that he took the spear only after he rose from the assembly, it is derived that one does not enter the study hall with a weapon. So it says, once Pinchas had left the collective of people, only then did he attack Cusbi and Zimri with a spear. And metaphoric shields prevent against metaphoric weapons, but they do not defend against actual weapons and actual bloodshed. So I thought this was very very apropos. And it's not just the Bavli that portrays legal interactions with metaphors of war and combat. In source number 11, I brought in, with great thanks to Dr. Rubenstein, I brought in a source that shows that Greco-Roman sources, for example, frequently bring analogies about court and debating in public to battle itself. So in Quintilian, we see that he says, he advises a young lawyer to prepare for court by writing out practice speeches, training himself with the real weapons of his warfare, as gladiators do. And we see that the sages in the Gemara really lived in an oral culture. They committed to memory the traditions they received from their masters. And in addition, there was even a professional class of memorizers known as Tana'im, or repeaters, and they served as these repositories of oral texts. And oral cultures typically evince a much more violent tenor than cultures in which writing is the most dominant mode of expression. Writing kind of mediates the interaction and lessens the immediacy of the experience, but with oral arguments, keeping knowledge embedded in the present, it keeps it in the context of the struggle. Conversation is really direct and unmediated and fast-paced, and that can prompt tempers to flare in a much more actual way than when someone takes the time to write down their grievances to one another. With written argument, it's much less about the issue, it's much more about the issue and less about the individual themselves. And these discussions and disputes conducted through letters are much more easily limited to the topic at hand, as the parties and the personalities tend to recede into the background, and they rely more on their own logic to defend their points of view, as opposed to this immediate back and forth kind of happening. And no matter how angry someone gets in a letter, you can't lash out and physically attack somebody who isn't there. So that's one reason that Dr. Rubenstein brings up about why it's so much more violent within the Bavli. But this begs the question, what about the Yerushalmi? So I think I mentioned this earlier, but really Palestinian stages, to a certain extent, did share some of this oral discipline with the Babylonians, so we find some metaphors here and there. I brought in source number 12 and 13, talk about sages in Israel at that time. Rabbi Yehoshua was in Israel, and Rabbi Zeira was in Israel. And we find some sort of violent imagery. So they asked Rabbi Yehoshua a halachic opinion, and he said to him, "Why do you interpose my head between two great mountains, the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, lest they crush my soul?" So this is less an argument, more of a violent metaphor to talk about the greatness of the generation that came before him. And in source number 13, it says, Rabbi Zeira said, "Were it not for the fact that I would be putting my head in between two lions, i.e. Hillel and Shammai, I would say the reason as to why I want to do things." Again, not an argument, just a weird image, but nothing too violent. And we don't find violence to the same extent in the Yerushalmi as we do in the Bavli. And this is because in Palestine, argumentation played a role in rabbinic life, but not necessarily the focus, nor what determined status within the Palestinian yeshiva system. There was less jockeying for ranks because the Palestinian yeshiva were much smaller than the behemoths in Babylon. And that's one point of view that comes up.
Was there revision also? In other words, when you were talking about oral versus written, do you think when you're writing, you have time to revise and calibrate
what you have to say?
So was there more of a process?
So the point that I brought up about there is just in terms of the arguments as they are presented to us, it's not an argument through letters. It's always an argument between two people side by side who are discussing it. So that was the point I brought up before. In terms of whether or not there is more revisement on the Yerushalmi versus the Bavli was much more edited. So it was actually the opposite. It was much more edited. That's why it's really difficult to learn Yerushalmi, because there's just, not a lot of gloss about what's happening. So I couldn't tell you whether or not there's more writing happening in the Yerushalmi versus the Bavli. It was just an idea. Anybody have thoughts, opinions, jokes? Yes?
I may have mentioned it before, I think you mentioned it. Just the cultural impact, like maybe living in Golis or Bavli versus the culture or the style of Eretz Yisrael. Is that in the readings? Is that at all discussed? Is that a possibility?
In terms of the societal norms that's happening, no one really talks about that. But we mentioned as a group earlier that you would even think just nowadays you'd think the opposite as to whether or not Israel is more argumentative. But there's nothing in the sources that seem to indicate a style of life.
Back to on the revision. Did it not? Like maybe they were consulting, they just got edited out.
I don't have sources that say that. It's a really interesting way to be. I'll look more into see if that's true, but I don't think it is.
It might have been academic politics, right?
Yeah. That's
kind of crazy to think about that.
That it's that's kind of crazy to think that because, I'm sorry, I don't understand.
I work in an academic environment, and there's this really dumb joke. Why are academic politics so nasty? Because the stakes are so low. Nobody actually cares if you're an assistant or an associate professor, except the people who are, like, enmeshed within it. But you wouldn't think that, like, people who are at the top.
Yeah. So it's really interesting because Dr. Rubenstein says just because of the way that the academy was structured, there was a lot of there's just a lot of, like, you need to defend your spot, otherwise it's not going to belong to you the next day. You need to make sure that you're the top dog.
Wow.
Yeah. It's also fascinating as to how human that kind of point of view is, that it really kind of places people back in a human sphere where it's not necessarily that these sages are incredible, that they definitely are incredible sages, that they do have human points of view and human feelings. So I thought it was really fascinating. But
I don't think it's sad that it was like that. I think it's actually a good thing because it shows how much it was the ikar. Like, this is what was important to them. And this is the position in the yeshiva. That's what was important to them.
So to wrap up, I just want to bring up one more idea. It was mentioned in this room earlier, but isn't there kind of a concept of v'ahavtalcha l'reicha kamocha? Isn't there this general Jewish principle that we have that we're supposed to be kind and lovely and loving to one another? Don't we have a personal, like, ethos of good behavior? Aaron is said an ohev shalom and a rodev shalom. He's praised as somebody who loves peace and chases after peace. So really, shouldn't these sages in the Gemara be following that kind of paradigm? It seems so kind of 180 degree spin as to what they're supposed to be doing. The last source that I brought in, source number 14, it gives us a rationale that's surprising in light of all these violent exchanges in the Bavli. So if I can get a volunteer to read the last source before our time is over. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, if I can have your name also.
Sorry, Ora.
Hi, Ora. Thank you so much.
Rabbi Abba said that Shmuel said, for 3 years Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagreed. These said, the halacha is in accordance with our opinion, and these said, the halacha is in accordance with our opinion. Ultimately, a divine voice emerged and proclaimed, both these and those are the words of the living God. However, the halacha is in accordance with the opinion of Beit Hillel. The Gemara asked, since both these and those are the words of the living God, why were Beit Hillel privileged to have the halacha established in accordance with their opinion? The reason is that they were agreeable and forbearing, showing restraint when affronted, and when they taught the halacha, they would teach both their own statements and the statements of Beit Shammai. Moreover, when they formulated their teachings and cited the dispute, they prioritized the statements of Beit Shammai to their own statements, in deference to Beit Shammai.
So in light of all the sources that we read, you might have thought that the Bavli attributed the preference for Beit Hillel for their sharpness or their ability to defend their point of view. But instead, the Bavli claims that Hashem sided with Beit Hillel based on the account of their benevolence to one another and the humility with which they treated their own halachic interpretations and the halachic interpretations of Beit Shammai. And by portraying the character of these early sages, Beit Hillel and Shammai, as gracious and claiming that Hashem rewarded them because of this, maybe the Gemara is constructing a model for the conscientious students of the time later on to kind of say that this was the ideal that you were supposed to live up to, maybe kind of work towards it. So I like ending Shiurim on happy notes. So I think that we should all strive to model Beit Hillel in appreciating others' points of view and not necessarily jumping out and lashing out at people who disagree with us. So thank you so much for learning with me today and for coming out in the cold. thank you so much. My pleasure.